for the week of December 11th, 2016. This is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 347, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Brooklyn, I'm Michael Giltz.
Wow, you've narrowed it down to Brooklyn. Why is that?
I'm narrowed. What do you mean narrowed? When you say I'm in New York City, you mean Manhattan.
Okay. All right. Well, I was waiting for you to say, I'm in Park Slope, Brooklyn on Flatbush Avenue.
I can't get to sleep. That's all I know about Brooklyn.
I can't.
Well, no, I'm here now, so maybe I can.
Okay.
So I'm staying with friends in Brooklyn. We got a show. We're recording on a Tuesday because you were super, super busy on a Monday. So we're running late.
Well, you were also doing something on Monday.
I was available on Monday.
Okay. All right. You don't want to tell people what you were doing.
Don't put it on me.
All right. Okay. Well, you're going to the opera tonight. What opera are you seeing? It's like a big opera, if I'm not mistaken.
I saw Rogue One, A Star Wars Adventure last night. You won't let me talk about that.
That's a space opera.
Salome at the Metropolitan Opera
that's
tonight.
Right.
And tomorrow night, I'm seeing the Les Amours de Loing, also at the Met. So very excited.
Wow. So you have a busy week and we have a busy show. This week on Showbiz Sandbox, we've got a lot on our plate, despite losing out on a post in the Trump administration. Thanks. And that head job at Viacom, we also missed out on that. For starters, we've got the winners of the European Film Awards and the Golden Globe nominations to ponder. During our book filter segment, Michael will name the books coming out this week that he would option if he were looking for fresh material to turn into properties for movies and TV. By the way, no need to give us a finder's fee, okay? But we wouldn't necessarily be offended either. On Inside Baseball, we'll look at the Grammy nominations, and after consoling Kanye West, we'd ask ourselves, if we were producing the show, who would we want to perform? Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the rest of the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. We have links to ComScore in our show notes. We also pull info from Box Office Profits, Box Office Mojo, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, The LA Times, The New York Times, you name it. And the number one movie around the world, at least for a few more days, is Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, with $43.8 million worldwide. That's just about to hit $700 million. I got that specific because right behind it is Disney's Moana with $42.3 million worldwide. So that was a close race worldwide. That movie, Moana, is just in 33 territories right now. It's at $240 million. Both movies are going to be home runs for their studios.
Well, why do you think it's the last week that Fantastic Beasts, or the last few days that Fantastic Beasts will be
Well, because I saw Rogue One last night, that's why.
Okay, so you think Darth Vader is going to come and take his lightsaber and just slash Fantastic Beasts apart?
I don't think that. We know it. It's not a competition.
Okay.
That's always the important thing. Number one at the box office this week is just a way for us to talk about who made the most money this particular week at this moment. But that didn't mean number two is a loser. Or number three is a loser. It just means this is the movie that's in the most territories and made the most money this week. What matters is how much money they end up making. And that's great news for Fantastic Beasts. It's going to be great news for Rogue One.
What about the number three movie?
Well, that's Office Christmas Party, which was such a dumb, obvious idea. I kind of hit myself in the head for not having pitched it years ago. It made $19 million and it's now at $34 million worldwide. Okay reviews. It only cost about $45 million. They'll probably be fine when all is said and done. And it's a Christmas theme movie. So they've got like 13 days before this sucker hits its sell-by date.
Right.
Right. Which is fine because, as we know, the 12 days of Christmas, there is a huge amount of movie going that's going to happen in the next 2 weeks. Huge amount. People go to the movies every single day. Kids are out from school. People are shopping. They want a break. Movies, movies, movies. There is a ton of money to be made every single day of the week from now until New Year's.
Well, and of course, then there's always the perennial DVD, Blu-ray, you know, having it on HBO and on television. It'll be every Christmas, you know, if it's a good movie like Elf, you'll see it, you know, again and again, year after year.
It's no Elf.
It's no
However,
Elf.
However, you've brought up Blu-rays, and I didn't know where to work this in, and we're losing our box office very quickly. We'll get back to that in a second. But I've noticed a trend in home video releases where they're releasing physical product, and they're really pulling away from Blu-ray. You will see big studios that they release movies and they give you a package with Blu-ray, DVD, and a digital download, which I think is great. But I'm seeing a lot more smaller films where you might think an indie film where they might just do one format. It ain't Blu-ray, even though that's the far superior format. It's just DVD. I don't know what the difference is in creating a Blu-ray versus a DVD, but they are really pulling away. Like, you get a digital download or you get a DVD, but Blu-ray is fading as an option for a lot of smaller films. I'm seeing that more and more. It started with TV shows, because that's where you're going to have 6 or 8 discs for a lot of American TV shows. And I guess DVD is still cheaper. And now I'm seeing it with a lot more movies. And I'm staying in different homes, and I'm finding a lot of people who don't have a Blu-ray player. I actually haven't had access to a Blu-ray player for a few weeks now. So that's a really interesting thing. Blu-ray is a great format. It had a heyday, and it seems to be fading away in the cheaper DVD format, which you can play in your, you know, laptop, but you can't play on your, you know, you can't play a Blu-ray on your laptop. No. That seems to have really come back a little bit, I think, as far as physical product.
And I think also the fact that DVD, well, I guess Blu-ray players were really the upscalers, but television sometimes upscale as well. So, you know, it's almost as if, well, yeah, I could buy the more expensive format, or I could just buy the cheaper DVD format and have my television make it look like the more expensive format.
But I'm finding people who don't have Blu-ray players. In the house I'm in, they don't have a Blu-ray. The last place I was in, they didn't have a Blu-ray. My brother doesn't have a Blu-ray player hooked up in his house. He watches things on demand mostly. He doesn't even watch physical product. But if you gave him something, it better be DVD. That's just an interesting little thing I've noticed in the last like 6 months to a year. They release everything digitally as soon as possible, usually giving themselves a few weeks advance so that they can say, hey, if you want it now, pay for it and get a digital download, because they make even more money on that. And then the physical product shows up. Blu-ray is fading into the background. Back to the box office. Mel Gibson had a good week. He got a Golden Globe nomination. His star Andrew Garfield got a nomination. And the movie Hacksaw Ridge made another $17 million worldwide. It's just about to pass $100 million. So that's going to become a profitable film. I know 2 Oscar voters. They watched it and they loved it.
Wow. Okay.
New York, you know, liberals. So, you know, that tells you something. A nice old-fashioned movie. They were all for it. So maybe there's life in that movie yet.
Well, and maybe Mel Gibson is kind of back. You know, for ages, he was a pariah here in Hollywood. Nobody wanted to touch him because of, you know, he kind of had a little bit of a tirade.
Racism and anti-Semitism.
Just a little thing.
Even before that, really, with his breakaway religious sect and other things. But, it got worse and worse. And now, you know, he's come back. People are accepting him and willing to say, you screwed up. We didn't like what you said, but we've moved on.
Right. And
not the worst thing in the world, though. I don't want to hang out with him myself.
Yeah, precisely. He was actually at the grocery store many years. This was like 3 years ago. I think I may have actually mentioned this on the show. And people were cutting him a wide swath as he walked through the store. It was like,
now they're going to come up and say, love the movie.
Right. Exactly. They didn't know what to say to him. And like, people were kind of looking like, oh, wow, there's the leper. I just thought, what is going, like, wow, you could actually feel a tension in the air as he walked through the room.
Well, you know, the one thing that was holding the movie back for its Oscar potential was possibly the Martin Scorsese film Silence, which Andrew Garfield also stars in. But that movie is getting not great reviews. It seems to be a difficult film. I'm sure there's a lot of love for Scorsese and it's a passion project. It may get Oscar love anyway. We'll know better when the Guild Awards start to come out, how well the industry feels, the people who actually vote for the Oscars. But that could have created a divide for Garfield and the movie and created some problems. But it seems like there's a little bit of momentum here. We'll have to see. Back to the movies. At number 5 is Your Name, the Japanese animated smash hit, which opened up in China last week or the week before. $14 million over the weekend, $276 million worldwide. Up next is Sully, the Clint Eastwood film starring Tom Hanks. $13 million over the weekend, $220 million worldwide. So that is a solid success story.
Although it looks like it's totally played out in the U.S. and Canada.
Well, that's why we're looking at worldwide box office. What do you mean?
Okay. No. I'm just saying I'm surprised that it's gone so fast. I mean, I guess it made $72,000.
Oh, no. It ran for quite a few weeks in the U.S.
I didn't get to see it. Okay.
Well, no, it had a good solid run in the U.S. But, you know, it's
an adult film. $125 million in the U.S. So, yeah, you're right. It's definitely made its money here.
Yeah, oh yeah, it made money, but it did over a number of weeks. It did not like come and go in a blink of an eye.
No, not at all.
At number seven is a movie you did see. That's Arrival, starring Amy Adams. That made $11 million over the weekend and $125 million worldwide. What did you think of the movie?
I liked it. I actually thought it was a thinking man's extraterrestrial movie, and by thinking man I mean thinking humans. Extraterrestrial movie. It was I enjoyed it. I thought it was a good story, well told.
And it's an Oscar lock for best visual language created for a film.
Yes, it does have a lot to do with entomology and languages. Yes, that's, I don't think they have an award for that, but if they did, it would win.
At number eight is Suddenly 17. This is a Chinese fantasy romance starring Wei. And of course, it's always hard to know in China because they flip the surname and the first name. So I'm not sure if her name is Wei or Wei. But in any case, she stars as a woman obsessed with her wedding, and it makes her fiance break up with her. Then she eats a piece of magical cake and goes back in time to when she was 17 again. So she gets a chance to relearn the lessons about what's important in life and choose all over again between the guy she's about to marry and the sexy hot guy she kind of liked at the time. We'll have to find out what lessons she learned, but the movie made $10 million over the weekend, and that's basically its opening total as well. At number nine is Sing, the animated movie that's about to open up here in the U.S. in a week or two. That's from Illumination. It made $10 million over the weekend. It's opened up in a number of territories around the world, so it's about 12 territories. This is just the latest success story for Illumination. They've had what? This is their seventh film. Every single one has been a hit. They've all cost between $70 and $75 million, essentially. That's at least what they've reported. And a lot of them are making a lot more than, you know, tripling their budget. Secret Life of Pets, Minions, Despicable Me. They've had one success story after another. They don't have the critical acclaim that Pixar has, but by God, they are making money.
Well, and they're actually marketing Sing really, really well. Every kid that went to see Fantastic Beasts also saw the trailer for Sing, and they all
want to
see
it. I don't know
that
that's really well. It's what you want, right? The big movie is coming out that's geared towards families. You want your trailer in on it, right?
Oh, absolutely.
It's sort of PR 101.
Right, but that doesn't necessarily mean you will secure that. I mean, so what I will say is...
Oh, so it's not the fact that they did it. It's just the fact that they were able to do it.
They were able to do it, and they cut a trailer where the kids come out actually kind of having memorized the lines of some of the characters. My kids really want to see this movie, and I hear them at school kind of talking about it and kind of going over some of the lines they heard in the trailer with their friends. So, you know, this is kind of geared up right now. It looks like it could be a hit, at least anecdotally.
All right, well, we've got a couple movies that have made $8 to $10 million. Underworld Blood Wars made another $9 million. Ally, the Brad Pitt flick, that made $8 million, and that's at $70 million worldwide. And a UK horror film called Pandora opened in the UK, I assume, and made $8.6 million so far. I don't know anything much about the Pandora, but I tried to figure it out, and I couldn't. I'm not sure what the premise is of that horror film, but presumably it'll come here at some point. And number 13 is Trolls, another animated film, and not about to be a success story, right? It made $7 million over the weekend, $315 million worldwide. It cost a reported $125 million to make, so it's just about to triple its budget, and that's a solid good sign. And as we know, family films play well as part of your library, so they're already probably in the black.
I was trying to figure out if Underworld Blood Wars had come out had been released in North America. It hasn't.
Well, it'll come. It'll come soon. I think it's in January or February, some off month where they're sort of going to hope to grab a little quick audience.
It's out in Latin America. So that's where that gross is coming from.
Right. Well, it's in 55 territories, at least this weekend, according to ComScore.
Oh, okay. So yeah, so it's out in more than Latin America. Okay.
Doctor Strange, just like Fantastic Beasts, another very successful franchise launch, $645 million worldwide. And then right below it, a much smaller film grossed $5.5 million worldwide. That is La La Land. That's, of course, the Oscar hopeful, huge, huge grosses in very limited release here in North America. So this is obviously shaping up to be one of those platform love fest.
Well, right you know, now it's in five theaters. Okay. Five theaters, $176,000 per theater. That is a huge amount that I think has only been beaten by the Budapest Hotel, the Grand Budapest Hotel.
Grand Budapest, as far as the limited release, blah, blah, blah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's a hugely high. It's the highest per screen average for I think of any films this year, except for it passed Moonlight. And it's a huge, obviously, per screen total. It's getting all the critical love they could want. It's perfectly set up as long as they don't, I think, expand it too quickly. I think they're going to be very, I don't know. It's always tricky. You know, what would you do? Would you want it on 500 screens, 300, 1,000?
I would platform it out a little wider and then a little wider still.
But what do you mean by a little wider?
Would you wait
2 weeks for Oscar nominations? Or are you going to get to 200 screens or 300 screens next week with Star Wars coming out? Or do you want to wait a week?
No,
it's a different audience, right?
I'd want it to be wide by the time Christmas rolled around.
Wide,
because that's, let's face it, that's what people are going to see who don't necessarily have to go see Star Wars or some of the kiddie films. That they're going to want to go see a good adult movie, and La La Land is from all accounts, an uplifting film. So
I don't think I'd want to be wide on Christmas Day, because I think you've got the Oscar nominations and the Oscar. I think you want a much longer view for this movie. I think you want to keep it full packed houses, people loving it, spreading love to their friends. And then I think you want to go wide in January when you've got the Oscar nominations. But that would be me. At number 16, another Oscar hopeful is Nocturnal Animals. Sperling, send back that Tom Ford fragrance. You can't keep it.
I didn't get a Tom Ford fragrance, although I do love his designs. And this is Tom Ford, the designer turned director. A Single Man was his first film. Nocturnal Animals is his second film. And, I guess his first film was at least a hit with critics. And Nocturnal Animals is a hit with most critics.
That's right. $4.3 million over the weekend, $16 million and counting. At number 17, we have a French film. It's called Tomorrow Everything Begins. Demain Tout Commence. It's a warm family drama starring Omar Sy of the film The Untouchables, which was a massive worldwide hit. Looking at the trailer for this movie, which grossed $3.5 million on its opening weekend, it's about a guy who is handed a baby by a woman. Clearly, she's like, this is your son. And he's like, what? And he has to raise his child. And it's heartwarming and touching. And I'm thinking, really? Like, 40 or 50 years after Kramer versus Kramer, we're still astonished that a man can raise a child. Is that still like so unbelievable to us?
Well, I guess it depends on who us is.
Well, you. I mean, don't you find it a little offensive as a man who is as involved with his children as his wife, if not more so? I'm not putting her, you know what I mean? Like, you're at home a lot of the time. You're raising your kids. Like, the idea that, do people say to you, oh, you're babysitting? Do they say that to you?
Maybe they do in France.
Okay, you're not fighting. Well, I think it's kind of ridiculous that this would still be a topic of amazement for a movie. Oh, my God, a man raising a child. I can't believe it. what do I do? Anyway, Manchester by the Sea, another independent film that's doing great, $3.1 million over the weekend, $8 million and counting. So that is also another film that is looking to capitalize on Oscar glory, and I think it's well poised to do that.
Well, now, do we want to get into, I guess, really the start of this? Well, we've started this march a long time ago, but the latest update in this march toward Oscars is, well, there's two, the European Film Awards and the Golden Globes, which is kind of ironic since the European Film Awards is, well, in Europe, and the Golden Globe Awards are, picked by the Hollywood Foreign Press Association.
I don't know if they're, it's their own award. It's like saying the BAFTAs are an international, it's like, they are British, they do the BAFTAs, the Europeans do the European Awards, right?
All right, fine, I was just trying to move us along into the awards section.
Okay. So yeah, Tony Erdmann was the big winner. That's the German family drama with humor. I don't call it a comedy because I think that's a little misleading. There's a lot of humor in it, but comedy isn't the word that springs to mind.
Have you seen this film? Have you seen it?
I have.
And did you like it?
I liked it. Yes. I didn't love it, but I did like it. I liked the leading performances a lot. It might be on my best of the year list, but I'd kind of want to see it again, but it is 2 hours and 40 minutes long, so it'll be a while before I'm ready to.
Right, exactly. I mean, you might recall when I was in Cannes, seeing Tony Erdmann, and I thought it was fantastic, and but it's a 2 hour and 40 minute, dramedy, and it's, 2 hours and 40 minutes could have been a little shorter.
I didn't feel like it was too short or too long. It's just a substantial time commitment. That's all.
Correct.
But it was certainly a good and worthy film. It beat out Ken Loach's film, I, Daniel Blake, for the top award at the European Film Awards, and certainly can't hurt it in terms of getting a possible Oscar nomination down the road, right?
That is correct. And the European Film Awards this year got rather political.
Well, everybody's political these days, aren't they?
Yeah, we're trying to be apolitical.
Agnieszka Holland of Poland, one of my favorite directors. It's been a while since she's made a great movie, but she's made some terrific films. And who knew she was funny? She's making little jokes about sitting herself at the Oval Office, flanked by security guards, making Trump jokes. Agnieszka Holland, I would not have picked for a card.
No, I mean, if you've seen her movies, you would definitely think, where did you get the sense of humor? Because Ms. Holland, that has not been your forte to date.
No, she's been doing serious dramas and is a terrific talent. She's done some good work in TV in recent years. And in a more serious note, the Academy, the European Academy, called on Russia to release Oleg Sentsov, who is a political prisoner. He's a Ukrainian director. He has been sentenced to 20 years in prison on faked trumped up terrorist charges. It's purely a political prisoner situation, and it's an outrage, and it's good that they're trying to shine a spotlight on that travesty.
Yeah, we've talked about this before, actually. Mm-hmm. Do you remember when we talked about this?
Sure.
Okay. But we've also talked about the Golden Globes in the past, and not to make light of Oleg Sentsov's current predicament, but you know, that the European Film Awards mentioned Tony Erdman. I think the Golden Globes, did they mention Tony Erdman at all? I don't know if they honored Tony Erdman, but they honored a whole bunch of other films. And why don't you give us a rundown of really what the significance here is?
Nothing.
What?
The significance is nothing. What matters are the Guild Award nominations. The people who actually vote on the Oscars are the ones that matter. All the Critics Awards, the Golden Globes, the broadcasting, none of it matters. None of it is a tea leaf to figure out who's going to get Oscars. It helps an Oscar campaign in the sense that maybe someone says, maybe I should check out this film. For example, Tony Erdman was nominated for Best Foreign Film by the Golden Globes. So that might be one more prompt for an Oscar voter to say, yeah, I guess I should check that out.
Right, correct. I would agree with that it can help you in that regard. And it's kind of one more step in the political campaign season.
That's
you know,
right.
It's real political. Listen to me. The Oscar campaign season. You know, I've got election hangover here.
They have 10 movies in their top two awards, which are Best Drama and Best Musical or Comedy. Most everyone pointed out, hey, guess what? This year, the films nominated for Best Musical or Comedy actually are musicals or comedies. So
right.
That was a big step forward for them, since they've had some oddballs shoved in there.
Well, think about it this way. Somebody said, yeah, I think Deadpool was a much funnier movie than, say, The Martian.
It was. Yeah, exactly. Well, it was.
Right. Well, that was the joke, is that, you know, The Martian was in Best Comedy. It won Best Comedy. And that was right. What's his name? Jim Carrey, kind of, he opened the envelope and he said, you know, once I say this, it can't be undone. He said Best Musical, The Martian.
Well, they want to be seen as a precursor for the Oscars and sort of tilting movies towards that. I don't think they did a great job this year. I think the five drama nominations are possibles, though I really put a question mark by Lion. But those movies are Hacksaw Ridge, Hell or High Water, Lion, Manchester by the Sea, and Moonlight. The last two are locks, Manchester by the Sea and Moonlight. The other three are less clear-cut slam dunks, but I think they're very possible. I really think Lion is just people are knee-jerk including it because it's Harvey Weinstein and they just don't want to underestimate his campaigns. But I don't think anybody's excited by that movie. But Best Musical or Comedy, I think that's where they really fell down. I only think one of these movies is going to really be an Oscar player, but maybe I'm wrong. They are 20th Century Women, which is a fine film that I saw, good ensemble cast, Deadpool, La La Land, which is, of course, a lock for an Oscar nomination, Florence Foster Jenkins, and Sing Street. I'm not talking about the quality of these movies, but I think maybe Florence Foster Jenkins, though, again, I don't think so. We'll get a better sense when we see who the SAG Awards like, who the Director Guild's like, who the Producer Guild's like. That's when we'll get a sense of whether there's any momentum for Florence Foster Jenkins and Meryl Streep yet again. If I was voting, I certainly wouldn't put it on there.
Well, now, you know, we're not going to go over all the nominees in the acting categories, but suffice to say, in years past, they would often nominate people who you would think, why is this person even being mentioned in this group? Not because they're not necessarily worthy for other work they may have done, but because what they're being nominated for is for a film nobody saw, nobody liked, it made no money, which doesn't necessarily count, but still, you know, you're kind of wondering, but then you go, okay, well, I could see they want Johnny Depp to show up to their show. They nominate
right, they're casting their award show, right?
Yes, that's where I was headed, is that they're kind of cherry picking the actors they want on television, because it is a show, it is something that is broadcast, and they have to get ratings, and Johnny Depp will get you some ratings. And I think the year after he was nominated for The Tourist, Ricky Gervais asked Johnny Depp, did you even see The Tourist? And Johnny Depp paused for a second and went, no. He walked up.
And this year, to their credit, you don't see any sort of ringers like that. There are no obvious, you know, snafus. You're like, oh, come on, really?
Right. Yeah. I mean, even, you know, Jonah Hill for War Dogs, you kind of go, well, I didn't see the movie, but nobody saw the movie anyway. But, you know, his performance was called out in reviews. So maybe.
And I'm sure he's not saying we got to get Jonah Hill on the show so we can pack in the reviewers. You
exactly.
Know? that's clearly not the case. No ill will meant towards Jonah Hill. But, you know, he's not a TV ratings draw yet, I don't think.
No, not at all.
Right. So that's, you know, again, it's not a nomination, which he got best performance by an actor in a musical or comedy. It's not one that makes you go, come on. Well, Ryan Reynolds for Deadpool? Absolutely. Why not? Absolutely. You got a comedy section. I think that's perfectly valid. He was the best thing in that movie, which I didn't love. But hey, why not? And Colin Farrell for The Lobster. I'm thrilled because that was a very good movie. It's certainly on my best of the year list.
Well, now, here's the thing. You said, you know, you don't think it really helps you win an Oscar, but we all know it can help you lose one. And what I mean by that is, you know, you get up and you give some cockamamie speech, or you kind of go off, or you know, you get unhinged. Look at what happened to what's his name for The Wrestler? Mickey Rourke for The Wrestler? He kind of gave some nobody could understand what he was saying on stage that night, and he was, it seemed, a lock for best actor in a leading role, and he lost that award.
That's true. Well, you know, if you are trying to read the tea leaves for Oscar hopefuls, you don't have to wait for nominations from the guilds. You can just look at the blacklist, can't you?
Well, that's true. I mean, the blacklist, of course, was put together by Franklin Leonard some time ago as a survey of scripts that were kind of working their way through the Hollywood development machine. And he would go out there and say, hey, you know, fellow development executives, what's out there? What scripts are out there that are unproduced to date that are good? You know, let's list the top 100 screenplays. Well, over the years, he has found movies like Spotlight, like Slumdog Millionaire, The King's Speech, Argo. Probably most famously, okay, is Juno. That was like, you know, very early on, they came up with Juno. And then, of course, it went on to win the Academy Award for Best Screenplay.
Right, you've got some stats here, don't you, about their track record in recent years?
Well, over four of the last 8 Academy Awards for Best Picture, they went to scripts that were featured in the blacklist, as I mentioned, the films that I mentioned, and 9 of the last 8 screenwriting Oscars were from...
18.
Oh, 18, okay.
50%.
50%. Yeah, because 9 of 8, that doesn't make any sense, were from the annual blacklist scripts. So that includes, by the way, The King's Speech, Social Network, The Descendants, Django Unchained, and I mentioned Argo already, and The Imitation Game. I kind of find it, you know, some of these picks on this list, Django Unchained, it's written by Tarantino. Really?
That's where I was headed. Big whoop.
Yeah.
For example, the list came out this year. There's 60 films on it.
Yeah.
And you know, 60 screenplays.
And when The Social Network was picked, it was written by Aaron Sorkin. It was being produced. It was like, yeah, why are you picking this? Yes, it's one of the best screenplays, but it's not one of the best undiscovered screenplays.
Well, and Spotlight, which you mentioned, co-written by Todd McCarthy, who was at the time already a hugely acclaimed writer-director of previous works. It's based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalism of the Boston Globe. This is not a project you plucked out of some obscurity. And there's many examples of this throughout the blacklist. I went through a couple years and just went, oh, come on, you know? In 2012, there were 17 picks, including, you know, screenplays based on hugely popular novels, one by a Pulitzer Prize winning playwright, a movie based on a hit TV show, one by the previous National Board of Review winner for best screenplay. You know, so, you know, It's not to diss it. It's a useful list. It's great. But let's not act. I take issue with the idea that the blacklist is somehow some sort of savvy system that finds jewels in the heap of, you know, unproduced screenplays.
Well, and when Juno was found, it kind of was that.
Done that. But when you pick 50 or 60 movies a year, you're going to hit and they're by people like Tarantino and Pulitzer Prize winners. You're not exactly finding diamonds in the rough.
Well, and Franklin Leonard was on this very program and explaining why, you know, those screenplays do get selected by the panelists. And I would have to look for that show. And
he would say, you know, they're not produced yet and they're hard to get. You know, even with big names, you can't always get your passion project made. Look at Scorsese for 30 years, 40 years trying to get Silence made. It ain't easy, even if you're a big name.
Well, now, Silence was a book, actually, before, you know, Scorsese made it and transformed it, adapted it into a movie.
Right. It was by Shuzaku Endo. It came out the year I was born, 1966.
Well, that was my way of moving us into our Book Filter segment. It's time for us to check out Book Filter, a book lover's best friend. And Michael, every week you pick some of the books we should be paying attention to. What is the book that you've selected out of the hundreds of thousands or at least tens of thousands of books that are published each week that we should be taking a look at?
Well, I was thinking about books that might be good projects for Hollywood studios. And also I was thinking about how hard it is to get attention. I sort of tweaked the blacklist, but you know what? They would say, hey, even with a big name, if we can bring attention to a project and make people know, hey, this is of value, and that helps it eventually get made, we're happy. We're not pretending that we're just finding absolutely obscure screenwriters no one's ever heard of.
No, my issue with the blacklist is if you're already in production, you can't call it an unproduced screenplay.
In production? No, well, certainly not. Is there examples of that this year?
The Social Network. The Social Network was being produced.
Was in production? Well, that's absurd. That's that's kind of ridiculous. And in this case, I was looking at a book called The Neuro Diaries. It's by Casey Schwartz. She's a best-selling author. Her previous book was called In the Mind Fields. And in this book, she sort of combines a memoir of her personal journey of a young woman entering science and academia, just as the studies of neuroscience and psychoanalysis are butting heads. So she's sort of telling the academic story of these two disciplines coming together and her own personal story as a woman coming into a field dominated by men. And she has received critical acclaim. She's hit the bestseller list. And you know what? This book, there's not a single review yet of this book out. It's not no reader reviews. There's no trade reviews. There's nothing online on Amazon or elsewhere. That's how hard it is to get attention for your book. There are hundreds of thousands of books that come out every week. And you know what? Books about women in science are a hot property. You've got Hidden Figures coming out. You've got a number of other books I've mentioned in the previous weeks. Casey Schwartz is a good talent, and it might be a book worth checking out.
You know, I read a story by her in the, I want to say it was the New York Times Magazine. And it was about her, I don't want to call it addiction to Adderall, but her experience with Adderall over a decade and how she first started taking it in college and how, you know, what it did and what Adderall is doing to an entire generation of basically, you know, between the, you know, 15 and 30 year olds. It was a fascinating read, and it was somewhat, it was autobiographical and memoir-esque, and it made me look her up, and I knew that this book, The Neuro Diaries, was being published simply because she wrote that article.
Because of that article, yeah. Well, that's, you know, you remember her name, and she's a best-selling author, and still she's having trouble getting some traction and visibility for this book. One person who doesn't have problem getting traction is James Patterson. We've talked about him before. He's created a syndicate. You know, he slaps his name on books. He works with other writers on the plot. He oversees them and he gets other people to churn out these books. He also writes books on his own. I'm sure his involvement in each book varies widely, but he's putting out like a book every other week, it seems like.
Yeah.
And he's moved well beyond thrillers. He now has books in the romance section, which still makes my head spin a little bit. And I'm not happy with the covers they choose. He's also into kids' books. He's done a number of successful ones already. And this week he has a new one. It's called Word of Mouse. Get it? Word of Mouse.
Yeah.
And it's by James Patterson and Joe Sutphin. And it's a middle grade book, kids for like fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth grade, about a mouse who has blue skin. So he's kind of a loner, kind of an oddball. And he befriends a little girl who's also sort of an oddball, and they become friends. So James Patterson is kind of doing an amazing thing in the book world, and he seems to be going from strength to strength.
Well, let me ask you something. You say you don't like the covers for James Patterson's romance novels. Do the covers depict him maybe shirtless or something?
No, they don't.
Because that would be a big deal.
That's right. And it's time for Big Deal, Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense.
You Sperling, stole my line.
What's our first story?
Well, CBS just made, what, $100 million? They're getting a kill fee because the Redstone family pulled the plug on the attempted merger of Viacom and CBS. Back in 2006, Viacom spun off CBS because it was, you know, it was old and stodgy, that CBS BlackRock network.
Boring.
But CBS turned out to be the source of innovation and growth. Viacom saw this as a reason to merge back together again, you know, rather than a call to do its own innovating. But with Donald Trump as president, the likelihood of a merger, which everyone involved insisted was a slam dunk, well, I guess it seemed a lot less slam dunky, which you can quote me on. And now it has officially collapsed. Bob Bakish is doing great, by the way, they say, and has just been named president, or not president, CEO, the permanent CEO of Viacom. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal, I think. I think it is because of the Trump administration and their hostility to this deal, as far as he expressed it during the campaign. Though, you know, frankly, he's backtracked already on a bunch of campaign things that he said, so I don't know why they necessarily panicked. But I think it's a good thing, right? Because I think it was a desperate ploy. CBS did not want to merge with them. They didn't really want to get back together. There were no clear advantages. It was just going to be one bigger, lumpier thing than what they had right now, which was a very successful CBS and a Viacom that needs work. So I think it's better for all involved, don't you?
Well, yes, possibly. Although I would say this, you know, the reason that, you know, CBS and Viacom, the Redstones, wanted to remerge them in part was because CBS could help bolster Viacom, which has weaker television networks right now during a time when, you know, the cable bundle is being kind of eroded, and also because of management. They were really looking at Les Moonves over at CBS and saying, okay, we want you to take over everything and kind of, you know, steer it the way you've been steering CBS. Les Moonves, on the other hand, was saying, great, so you're going to basically give me this cancerous Viacom.
This big mess.
Yeah, I don't want to un-not that mess.
Yeah. They wanted strong leadership, but I don't think merging two companies back together again really solved that problem as such.
No, and from what industry insiders, what people inside the negotiations were saying was that it came down to valuation, that CBS did not agree with what Viacom believed its value was. So CBS wasn't going to necessarily purchase Viacom for more than $40 a share, and they're trading now at like $33 a share. So, you know, it just came down to valuation.
All right.
Sundance announced its lineup for the 2017 version of its famed film festival. We were going to ignore it or maybe just mention it in passing. Film festival announces films, you know, a person gets a job. Big whoop. But they definitely caught our attention with the opening.
Hi, Karen.
Yeah, exactly. Karen Woodward, that's her claim to fame. Yes. Okay, so the opening night film is what caught our eye. Al Gore and his collaborators are delivering a sequel to An Inconvenient Truth, updating the science and the facts about global warming from the past decade. Spoiler alert, the news ain't good. We're still killing the planet. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop in terms of things, but it's fascinating, right? We'll have to see in the political environment we're in. I've mentioned politics again when I chided you for doing it, how this movie is going to play. You know, this is a huge issue. The U.S. was making a lot of progress that may be in danger. This movie could maybe change the conversation again. It couldn't come at a better time, and they certainly didn't plan it this way.
No, not at all.
Right. They didn't know. But a 10-year update is absolutely called for. It makes a lot of sense. There's a lot more science now. Every trend line we had 10 years ago and even 40 years ago has proven accurate in broad terms and is getting more and more serious and severe. So it'll be interesting to see how they sum it all up for everyone. It can't hurt.
Especially after recent events, as you put it.
Yeah, we do not want to backtrack on fighting global warming. And there's a lot of money to be made. So, you know, it's a win-win.
And you know, I first met Al Gore at Sundance.
There you go.
The Rush, by the way, is on. And what I'm talking about is the rush to track TV watching across all platforms. We talked about it last week, and now Nielsen is acting specifically because we talked about it. They are in advanced talks to purchase the company Gracenote for $400 million or more. Gracenote began as a way to tag the information on music CDs. It was actually kind of an open source project. There's some controversy around that, but be that as it may, it started out just, you know, for music CDs. Now, their tags have been incorporated into a lot of digital content and into TVs from major manufacturers. Nielsen will be using that to follow content like TV shows and movies wherever they get watched. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I guess it's a big deal. They need the technology in order to track television. If it's the right price, it's a good purchase. My God, they should be doing this years ago.
Yeah, no, I agree. Putting his money where his mouth is, composer Andrew Lloyd Webber is making his new musical, School of Rock, available to perform in schools. Now, right away, as in today, for free. They won't have to pay the rights fees this usually entails, and they won't have to wait years for their first chance to stage it. Even more, he'll make scripts, scores, and other necessary tools available to schools free of charge. Lloyd Webber has often said new musicals should be available for kids to perform right away, and now he's backing that up. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big deal. One could say, you know, the guy's worth a gazillion dollars. What does he care? Why not? But you know what? No one else has ever done that before. And they've made, you know, you make a hit Broadway show, you're worth a gazillion dollars. Not like him necessarily, but you're set for life. So, but, you know, the fact is school productions are a pretty serious source of income for composers. So, you know, you're young, you're new, you're struggling, you can't afford to. He can afford to do this, but then he chose to do it. So full credit to him.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if you are his investor,
his heirs,
you kind of wonder, hey, you know, we invested in this show, right? But maybe there are no investors, or maybe the investors have, you know, made their money back, and I don't know. There's probably,
I don't know how that works.
Yeah.
It is a source of revenue though, so it's nothing to be sneezed at.
Exactly. Now, forget screening room, Michael. You remember the screening room that
I know, do?
Yeah. The latest business to try and buy their way into Hollywood's affections by buying off talent is Atom Tickets. The app wants to take on Fandango, the web ticketing company here in the U.S. and Canada. And actually now they've purchased a whole bunch of companies like Cine Papaya and Ingreso in Latin America. Well, they believe they can do so with innovations like learning what theaters you favor, making it easier to split the cost of tickets for a group, discounts to slow selling showtimes and prepaying for concessions. You know, all the things that normal, you know, the AMC app does for you. And why compare it to Screening Room? So why are we comparing Atom Tickets to Screening Room? Because Atom is touting the fact that J.J. Abrams, Steven Spielberg, and Tyler Perry are all on its board. Abrams and Perry are stakeholders, but it wasn't clear if they invested or were handed a piece of the company. Spielberg's financial ties are unknown, and of course, people on boards tend to be paid money for devoting their time. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop, right, until they make some progress. But they say, hey, look, there are 5 billion seats that go unsold annually in North America. Because even big hit films now on 3,000 screens, you go at 10 a.m. on a Thursday, there's not going to be anybody there. You know, that's just a fact. I don't know if discounting the tickets is going to get people to flock to the theaters at those off times. You know, I don't know. You say everything else they offer is already being done by other apps, so it's hard to find out where they're going to get a foothold. But I do find it intriguing that these big names are willing to, sure, give me a piece of your company.
Well, you know, these slow-selling showtimes, the discounts for slow-selling showtimes, that is not necessarily done by other apps or other companies. Certainly there are some that are trying it, but...
Do they have theaters on board to do that?
Well, Atom Tickets does, some theaters, certainly. We've talked about them in the past because Disney was a, you know, kind of a big advocate, proponent. They're somehow a part of Atom Tickets. I would have to go and look up. At the end of the day, this is just another third-party ticketing company to take on Fandango. And you know, right now it's movie tickets and Fandango here in North America. And Fandango really is kind of cleaning everybody's clock. So having somebody, you know, an upstart like Atom Tickets show up, it just provides more competition for the studios to kind of keep prices down.
And I think the discounting tickets at off times is good as long as you're actually discounting it and not charging a premium for the times when people really want to go, because that would just be annoying. The ticket prices are already too high. So, okay, yeah, you got a 10 a.m. showing on a Thursday. You want to make cheap. Fine, but don't use that as an excuse to raise the price for your main tickets.
Well, and the reality is, yeah, I'd love to be able to go to the movies at 10 o'clock in the morning on a Thursday. I would love to. So it's very often a time issue, not a money issue. Now, apparently, getting insurance for your movie doesn't cover breaking the law. The producers of the ill-fated Midnight Rider sued their insurers to cover money lost when the movie collapsed after a tragic accident killed a camera assistant. We've talked about it a lot on this show. The movie was shooting on train tracks, on property, without proper permission, and against safety regulations. The director went to jail, OSHA had evidence rules were broken, and the director's own deposition was damning. The insurer said, "You can't break the law and ask us to pay up." And now a judge has agreed. Though it is possible the producers can bring separate action against their insurers on some other claims they had. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I guess it's a big deal. It would have been a little bizarre, I think, if someone had gone to jail and the movie was pilloried for what, you know, breaking these rules and having somebody be killed and then the insurers had to pay up. It's like, yeah, no, you don't get to insure yourself for criminal actions. So I guess it's an expected ruling. You know, it's a sad, awful mess, the whole thing, of course.
Yeah, and I think the other claims are the fact that the insurance company may have hidden certain evidence that actually they did have permission to be on the tracks.
I think it's more that they say that's not true, the insurer and I believe the judge. I think it's more about the claim that they tried to harm them in other ways financially after this whole brouhaha began. I don't think it's about like the insurer somehow knew they actually really did have permission. There were emails and the judge said, no. Even on the day of, you were reaching out and you were being told you couldn't be there and shouldn't be there and you still went there. The judge slapped down the idea that they actually had permission of any reasonable sort. And he says, the judge said no. So I believe it's some other issues that after this all started, they claim the insurers tried to harm them financially in other ways. I'm not sure what their beef is, but there is no hidden evidence that they really did have permission. The judge said, no, that's ridiculous.
Yeah, he did not. Well, but he didn't allow that evidence to be entered. So therefore, their claim was kind of moot.
He didn't say there was evidence. He said that's not true. Even the day of the shooting, you were trying to reach out. You were being told you shouldn't be there and you went there anyway. So no, you did not, under reasonable circumstances, have permission to be there, nor did you secure the site. So, you know, that's it. All we know is that they're paying a price. And if that means other movies tend to be more careful in the future, good.
What's it called when you embrace information that reinforces what you already believe? I think it's called confirmation bias.
Or being Michael.
Well, I'm just going to say that may explain why Michael included this next story. It's about a survey, a random poll, which is exactly the sort of data Michael usually poo-poos. But in this case, it's a survey of people who watch sports. Guess what? Almost all of them use their DVRs to tape live sporting events. 84% say they do just that, if only to make sure they don't miss the beginning and end of a game. And more than half of the people who do use their DVR to record sports say they also use it to do this little thing called skip over the ads. Sure, the survey was funded by a company called Thews Sports. That works with networks to promote sports. So, you know, in a way, you have to wonder. But since the findings are actually not what TV people want to hear, that kind of makes this data a little more trustworthy. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop because it is just a random survey. We don't know how well it was executed, etc. But I don't understand why we need surveys. I know you've talked before about people need privacy. They don't want their information, you know, analyzed like this. But why can't cable companies give accurate breakdowns, at least for households, of what's going on? Why? I mean, the Nielsen rate, all this stuff is like they got to have a base of cable boxes in tens of millions of homes. I don't understand why they're not, you know, anonymizing and pulling that aggregate data to say this is exactly what's going on.
They
should know exactly what's going on. We should not be basing our ratings on like a 400 household sample. It should be on the tens of millions of people who would be perfectly happy to show their support for a show be registered in the Nielsen ratings.
Well, and they actually are in the live plus seven. That plus seven, those numbers are actually real numbers because that data is
they don't pull it from all the cable boxes in the country. No, they don't.
Well, TiVo does. I mean, TiVo actually gives the exact. And by the way, remember
is
back
that
in,
Nielsen? Is TiVo Nielsen? TiVo says this is what people have done live plus seven, and that's not a sampling; it's the total number.
Correct. Yeah, and they basically give that over.
Why
to Nielsen.
Isn't everybody doing that? Time Warner Cable doesn't do that.
I don't know.
Comcast
I can't speak.
Doesn't do that. Nielsen ratings are based on tiny, tiny little scientifically done samples, but nonetheless, I don't understand why we're not using that base of 90 million homes with satellite and cable to say this is what people are watching based on these numbers, at least household, and this is how they're using their DVR. Why is there a debate and a survey about sports watching? They know exactly what people are doing, or they can know it, but they should know it. Why aren't we getting that information?
Well, I can tell you why. Usually when there is data that people are not giving you, it's because they don't necessarily want it to be known. The Murdoch clan owns about 40% of European satellite TV giant Sky. Now they want to own all of it. Through 21st Century Fox, they are offering $23 billion. I'll take it. I'll take the $23 billion. Well, they're offering it to gain complete control of the company. Sky has 22 million subscribers in five countries. Big deal or big whoop.
That's like $1 billion per million customers.
Yeah, that's a pretty expensive cost of acquisition, cost of customer acquisition.
Well, that's a big whoop, right? They've owned it. They've wanted control of it for a long time. They've got a big chunk of it. They want the rest. We knew this was coming.
Right. So,
but why I get confused about 21st Century Fox versus 20th, because on movie labels, you still see in theaters, it still says 20th Century Fox for the actual movie.
Right. That's the film division is 20th Century Fox. 21st
Why don't they update that as well?
I've never been able to figure that out. 21st Century Fox is like the old News Corp. It's the owner
right.
of, yeah.
Right, it is. But I'm just, I'm not sure. Are they going to keep 20th Century Fox in the 22nd century?
I don't know. And
we'll have
you know
to
what?
Wait 84 years to find out.
I have a feeling I might not still be here. I might have moved on. Okay. You know, Showtime's dramedy series Shameless is starting to shoot its 8th season, Michael. Or actually would be, except for a salary dispute. Emily Rossum has co-starred with Bill Macy, wait a second. What do you want, first name basis with him? It's William H. Macy.
We're friends.
Okay. Well, you know, she's starring as the matriarch of the unruly clan on the show. And she has this crazy idea, and get this, that after 7 successful seasons, that, you know, she deserves to make the same amount of money as Macy. Okay. That's her concept. You know, I don't know how it's going to play. The show's producers finally agreed and offered her the same new deal that Macy has. But wait. Since she's been making less than Macy for 7 seasons, maybe now Rossum should be making even more. So Rossum is still holding out. Shameless ranks among the top 5 in cable dramas in total audience and key demos. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. It's a constant fight. It never ends. And, you know, if you watch that show, you know that Emily Rossum is not like the second lead, or she is the dominant figure in the show, even more than William Macy. She really is. He's a big name, you know, a relatively big name. He's gotten Emmy nominations and wins, and he's a popular actor. He's a terrific actor, but she really is the heart of the show. They've almost killed off his character, and the show could continue without him. It really couldn't continue without her, really, without being radically rethought. So she really is a co-lead in every sense of the word, if not even more dominant. And more power to her for holding out. You know, it's been 7 years. If she doesn't hold out now, it's never going to happen.
Yeah, and I don't know that they can go all the way back 7 years and say, okay, well, we'll pay you more now for all those 7 years. But,
well, she says, I just want a little bit more. You know, she's like, all right, now they're willing to pay her the same after 7 years. She's like, you know what? Actually, I got a lot of ground to make up. Maybe I should be making a little extra.
Yeah.
She is, you watch that show, she dominates that show. It is really her show. You know, he helped make it happen. He's a terrific talent, but this is not like, you know, second banana trying to get their fair share. She really has been the beating heart of that show. And again, about Nielsen ratings and cable, who the hell knew Shameless was a top 5 show on cable?
I had
no
idea.
Who the hell knew that? No idea. Showtime, all you people, why are you hiding the information about how big your audience is? You're doing a terrible job of getting the word out. I want to know, and I don't know. Most people have no idea.
Well, you know, one reason might be because if you knew that Shameless was a top 5
great.
Show, then you might, as an actor, say, hey, we're
no,
a top
no,
5
no, no,
show.
No, that's not. No, they want shows to last and run. They do not want to keep secret that a show is popular. It's not that. I think that's a different issue.
The New York City-based bookstore Shakespeare and Company is looking to expand. This was a bookstore that was like right in the heart of my campus at New York University.
It still is.
Yeah. They've got 2 sites in the city, including one with a small footprint, a cafe, and a print-on-demand espresso book machine, which I have to say, I have not been able to get a coffee out of that thing in all the years it's been there. Anyway, that's their model for the future, and they've raised nearly $8 million of a desired $12 million to start opening up new branches akin to the ones that they already have. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Akin to the one. The other one has a bigger footprint and contains their headquarters. So it's really that one that you know of from NYU that they want to model. It's a big deal. An actual bookstore wants to actually expand. $12 million seems like pretty penny-ante stuff to me. We'll open two stores, and in 4 years, we'll open two more. But hey, anybody wanting to expand, they think their formula works. The idea, I guess, is when you get a print-on-demand book and you got to wait for it, you do go buy an espresso while you're waiting.
That's a good idea. You know what? Hold on. I got to make a phone call to Barnes & Noble.
Yeah.
The organizers of the Trump inauguration are looking for celebrities to perform, and it's not proving easy. We'll do it. Michael and I will be there. No. And anyway, that's no surprise since the Trump campaign proved notably lacking in star power throughout the general election with Ted Nugent and Chachi among the few stalwarts. Chachi? Now, first it's Bill Macy. Now it's Chachi. We can't even go with the guy's real name, Scott Baio. Okay.
Fair enough.
They did announce that Elton John would be performing, which sounded like really good news until Elton John said, no, I'm not. Country stars seemed the most likely, but during the election, very, very few country stars spoke up one way or the other, a notable lack of partisanship for a genre that usually tilts to the right. Still, Lee Greenwood and Garth Brooks are reportedly in talks. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop. It really doesn't matter in the scheme of things. My natural inclination, being someone who didn't support Trump, was, ha ha, can't get, you know. But you know what? As Aaron Rich pointed out to me, he's a movie critic that we've had on our show a number of times over the years. As he prodded me to remember, you know, these celebrities, talk about hypocrites. We've talked about it before. The number of them who have played for brutal dictators and their children and countries with grotesque human rights abuses. Celebrities in Hollywood and the music industry who go perform and play in Abu Dhabi or vacation there in the UAE and countries all over the world. I mean, these people say they won't perform for Trump. Well, Beyonce and Usher give private shows to the brutal dictator, the son of Gaddafi.
Right.
You know, they get millions of dollars. Who parties with him? John Bon Jovi and Lindsay Lohan and Russell Simmons and Jay-Z. Mariah Carey did the same thing. Sting played for the daughter of the president of Uzbek, who had slaughtered protesters and engaged in countless human rights abuses and had a terrible environmental record. And Sting lied about it and said, oh, UNICEF sponsored the event. And then when that was proven false, he said, well, cultural boycotts are misguided. Nicki Minaj played for a company owned basically by the head of Angola, another country with horrific human rights abuses and corruption, including the killing of politicians and protesters and journalists. Mariah Carey went there for a Christmas show. Jennifer Lopez in Turkmenistan. Kanye West in Kazakhstan. Erykah Badu in Swaziland. Countless acts played Sun City over the years when apartheid was in full bloom, like Sinatra and Queen. So it's kind of nice for them to say, hey, we don't want to play for Trump. I wish they showed the same backbone and respect for human rights everywhere around the world and not just here in the United States.
But you're forgetting one thing, Michael, about all of those instances that you just cited. Uh-huh. And that one thing is kind of important. It's that when they did those things, when those artists went to those places and performed those shows, they weren't expecting anybody to notice. And
but they still do it.
Oh, I know. I'm just saying that, you know, when they play those shows, they're expecting it to be semi-private and, you know, nobody will actually ever hear about it. When you play the inauguration, everybody's going to hear about it and they don't want that to happen.
I think that might have been true 20 or 30 years ago, or 40 years ago, but I don't think that can be true for the last 20 years.
Well,
I
certainly
think
not the last 10.
Realize, yeah, I think, and a lot of those have happened in recent years. So that was true once upon a time, but I just don't think it's true anymore. And so I just don't understand it.
Well, that does wrap up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Now, I can tell you this week, the Grammy nominations certainly have everybody, both sides, film, television, it doesn't matter. Everybody's talking about the nomination, specifically Beyonce getting the nomination, and we'll go through them. But what do you think, Michael?
Well, I think this week we have also got the Billboard albums, and it's just fun to see how diverse the Billboard charts are now that we have actual reporting of sales rather than what happened in the old days. And there at the top, you know, you talk about the mix of Hollywood and theater and Broadway and music. The Hamilton mixtape is the number one album in the country. I think it actually sold 169,000 copies and 21 million streams, which I like that breakdown. But that's the number one album in the country. Big pop stars singing songs from a Broadway show. That's never happened before. Not in that way. I mean, it's happened eventually. Like Sinatra did an all-star cover of some Broadway shows. And they, you know, he and Sammy Davis and others did, you know, shows like Guys and Dolls and whatever. But boy, this has not happened in a long time in this way. It's pretty damn cool. But it's a great diverse top 10, and that's what's going to happen with the Grammy Awards. I mean, you've got The Weeknd at number two, the a cappella group Pentatonix with two albums in the top 10. The Rolling Stones have a blues album. Donald Glover, who's in the hit show Atlanta, which he helped create, his rap persona Childish Gambino is at number five this week. The Moana soundtrack is on there. And then you got a kid from America's Got Talent, the ukulele player, Grace Vanderwaal. She's like 12.
Yeah.
She's on there. She's in the top 10. And you got Kane Brown, the country singer, who's in the top 10. So that's a pretty awesomely diverse, interesting top 10 of music. And I think that's what they want to have come Grammy time. They want you to watch that show and not just, they want you to see the music you're talking about. And I think that was the big positive response for the nominations. Most critics said, hey, you know what? The album of the year and the top singles, a lot of them reflect music that people are listening to. And that means on the charts, it's R&B and pop is really dominating. R&B and hip hop and pop are dominating. And so that's what's on the charts. Not a lot of rock and roll, not a lot of old people that is loved by the Grammys, but doesn't have the heyday anymore. So that's what you've got when you look at the best albums of the year, right? And what are they?
Well, the best albums of the year are 25 by Adele. At least these are the nominations for album of the year. Lemonade by Beyonce. Purpose by Justin Bieber. Kind of shocked me. Views by Drake. A Sailor's Guide to Earth by Sturgill Simpson.
And that's the oddball left field pick. One of my favorite albums of the year. Absolutely, A Sailor's Guide. And it's going to be a really good coming out party for Sturgill Simpson. We're going to talk a lot about casting the show, right? Now they've got the nomination, so now all the producers and people of the Grammys say, okay, who are we going to invite? What are we going to do? Where are they going to be in the show? And what you're looking for a lot of times, especially if it's the really fun things, is to somebody that you can showcase and have them break out like they never did before, like Ricky Martin, or just give that memorable performance like Suzanne Vega did when she killed it again with Luca. And I think Sturgill Simpson is a terrific performer, really well respected in the community. I think he's going to get a showcase and really win a whole new level of viewers because I expect him to hit it out of the park.
Well, yeah, I'm a little surprised at some of the omissions and not necessarily Kanye West, I realize. I think Leonard Cohen's album came out too late. And it may not have made it anyway. David Bowie's Black Star, I thought, you know, was probably one of his best album in years. Now, it wasn't, you know, it was like seven songs. I get it. But didn't really get up to album of the year. Car Seat Headrest, I thought also might.
I thought they should have been in there. Yeah, that's a great album.
And maybe Paul Simon's Stranger to Stranger. People really seem to like that album, and yet nobody didn't get picked. And Bon Iver's album, well, Bon Iver is a kind of an acquired taste, so I could understand why maybe it didn't get picked.
Well, I think Paul Simon and some others would have been sort of the lazy, obvious, typical. That's not an album that's doing particularly well. It got polite reviews, but it's not that great an album. It hasn't held well over a couple weeks of listening, at least for me. So I was glad it wasn't a knee jerk. I mean, I am crazy about Paul Simon. I wish the album was better. But Black Star is a great album, and it's his best album probably in 2 years because he had The Next Day, which was a terrific album, his best in many years. That was just a year or two earlier. So that was a little surprise. But guess where you find all the old geezers? Best Alternative Music Album. I mean, that sounds like a category where you'd have cool, edgy, hip young bands. And instead, it seems to be the old folks' home of the Grammy Awards. You got Bon Iver, David Bowie, PJ Harvey, Iggy Pop, and Radiohead. So that's where the old folks go to play. Best alternative album. It's funny how these things work out.
Well, I think it's alternative because we used to call it music, but we don't anymore. Here's a question. If you are in that category, do you just like go, I'm not even going to show up? I mean, you know who's going to win that.
Bowie, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, you never know. It could be Radiohead. I mean, there's other really terrific albums on there. But yeah, he probably is a good bet to win that one. And you mentioned Kanye West being ignored, and I agree, actually. I think he delivered his best album since Dark Twisted Fantasy. So that was kind of a shocker. He deserved to be nominated. He is in some categories, especially rap. He's not one of the most nominated artists in Grammy history. He just hasn't been nominated and won Best Album of the Year. But since you've got him, and he's up for a lot of rap awards, and he's a terrific live performer, do you say, of course, you say, Kanye, come on and do Ultra Light Beam. That's one of his nominated songs because that pairs him up with Chance the Rapper and Kelly Price and gospel singer Kirk Franklin. you know, and he could just have a great blow him out the roof, you know, prove to them, Kanye, how great you are. You know, maybe he doesn't, I don't want to perform. You know, he's busy meeting with Trump, apparently.
Well,
but,
yeah,
that would be a great Grammy moment to see him do a great performance and show people why he deserves to be on that stage.
Yeah, I would say, given, you know, he's had some recent mental health issues, I would say.
Well, assuming he's healthy and ready. I mean, that's for his people to decide. As far as the Grammy people, do you invite him?
Yes. And I would say, don't do any live performances until then. You know, if you're his people, literally, and I don't mean that in a negative way. I mean, this should be your welcome back moment.
Well, that's true. And, you know, if I was packaging it up, sometimes they like to do two or three acts together. I might say, let's take us to church, because Ultra Light Beam is a really gospel infused song, hence the presence of Kirk Franklin. I might have him do whatever he wanted and then segue right into Kirk Franklin doing a song from his new Grammy nominated album. And then maybe the Blind Boys of Alabama with their track from their Grammy nominated album. So you could really, you know, they like to do segments where you sort of bring alive jazz or classical or gospel. This might be the area to do that, to show the links between rap and gospel and blues, and it would be a good, it would be a great, you know, little mini concert.
Now, if you're up for Record of the Year, do you just immediately go, "Hey, Adele, get up on stage so we can give you this award for Hello"?
No, I don't think those are locks necessarily. It's not clear to me what will work out. I mean, certainly Hello was a big hit. It's a good bet to win Record and Song of the Year, but I don't know. I think Formation, for example, that's the Beyonce song. That's up for Song of the Year. That's a Record of the Year, as it is nominated for. It doesn't deserve to be a Song of the Year. I don't think that's a standard that people are going to sing in years to come. Same thing with I Took a Pill in Ibiza. I don't think that is a Song of the Year good nominee. But the question is, you have Adele and Beyonce. They're going to perform on the show. Do you want them to do these hits that people have heard a lot, or do you say, give us a new song?
You know what? I think you want them to. You want them to play the hits, right? At the end of the day, you want.
Sometimes they come up and they do their latest, freshest hit, and it's not always. You know, if a song's been out for a year, you know, it might be too long for the. You know, they're like, no, that's boring. We've seen her perform it a bunch of times. Now we want them to do something new. That's what, you know, that's a hard choice. What do you do?
Well, I think that if it has been televised, if there has been a televised performance of it, then yes, you absolutely, especially at an award show, go for the new song.
Did Beyonce do Formation at the Super Bowl?
Yes, she did. So, yeah. So maybe, yes, maybe then you definitely go for a new song.
All right. I have a crazy idea. And this is
Wait, just one? Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. This is one that they haven't done before. But you've got great... Dylan is nominated, right? He's the Nobel Prize winner, Bob Dylan. He's nominated for his Standards album. Do you let him come up there and croon and do a Sinatra cover? I know you want him to do some classic song to sort of reflect the fact that he won the Nobel Prize. But it's Bob Dylan. You say, well, if you want to come, do whatever you want.
Strangers in the night.
Yeah. But what I looked at was the nominees for Best Comedy Album and Best Spoken Word Album. Categories that are, of course, ignored at Grammy time because it's the Grammys, it's music. But these are Grammy nominees. And if you look at this, the spoken word section, you've got Carol Burnett, sure, and Amy Schumer. But you've also got Patti Smith, Elvis Costello, and John Doe. In the comedy albums, you've got Amy Schumer again and great comics like David Cross, Margaret Cho, Tig Notaro, and Patton Oswalt. Why not let Amy Schumer do some bit? Why not let her read a great story from her new book or have some of the other people, Elvis Costello? I mean, or I think why not have the five stand-up comics do fresh material or something from their album? Give them 2 or 3 minutes and pepper them throughout the show. Why not shine a spotlight on categories that they constantly nominate but always ignore come Grammy time?
Well, a couple things here. One, the Elvis Costello nomination and some of these nominations, they're for like books,
memoirs,
right? Memoirs, yeah. So I don't know if you could do that, but as far as the...
Of course you could have them do it. Why not?
Well, maybe not for 3 minutes. 3 minutes is a long time on television when you have them reading from their memoir.
Telling a story from the book, but just have the stand-ups do it. Have them do a stand-up routine. Why not? They're nominated for Best Comedy Album. Let David Cross do 2 minutes. Let Margaret Cho do 2 minutes. Tig Notaro, you know, music, 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 2 minute comedy break. Music, 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 2 minute comedy break. Why not?
Well, certainly you could do it during a changeover or as a bumper going to commercial or coming back from commercial, but it's all about pacing, right? I mean, you're always trying to figure out the pacing. And if you've noticed, they've had very few kind of talky moments in the Grammys lately.
Right. And if they should, it would be hilarious comics that they say are the best comics of the year who released the best comedy albums of the year. At least Amy Schumer, I think. Why not give her a spotlight? She's up for best spoken word and best comedy album. I think it makes sense. What if you want to lower the age of viewers? Obviously, you want Justin Bieber on stage. You might also want to put Panic at the Disco or Cage the Elephant up on stage. They're in smaller categories than Album of the Year, but they're great live performers, and they've got strong followings among younger people. And I also looked at the best world music categories. You've got Caetano Veloso and Gilberto Gil. They did a duet album together, which is absolutely wonderful. They're two legends. And, you know, you want to shine a spotlight on different categories. Those two legends recording together and touring together, they would be a magical moment on the Grammys.
What about something for, like, the kids? You know, I've got two kids. What about something for them?
Well, obviously, although they're supposed to be, we'd want to shine the spotlight on jazz.
Oh, okay.
Actually, Tierney Sutton, her band, did a cover of Sting. And okay. Branford Marsalis has a great jazz album with Kurt Elling. Those would be a great thing for the jazz category. I know your kids are big on that. But there is also a kids category. And whatever the best, greatest track is, I'm not familiar with the acts this year. Sometimes in years past, I am. But I don't know if they've ever had a kids category person perform. There's great performers now in creating children's music. It's gone way beyond Rafi. Whoever is the breakout star in that area who has got a great song that everybody would love, you should showcase them. That would be awesome for that category. That would be awesome for the audience. And it would have a shot at lowering the viewership of the Grammy Awards. Do it early on in the show.
I know that Elizabeth Mitchell used to be, the singer. I don't know if she has a new album out or not, but she used to be a big kids performer.
She's not up for a Grammy this year, I don't believe, but it's fun. You look at the list of nominees and you see there's a lot of great talent. There's a lot of people to spotlight. It's impossible to cover everyone in every genre and every category every year, but you've got a lot of great country artists this year, a lot of young women with significant nominations. So it's going to be a coming out party for like Maren Morris and Brandi Clark and Kelsey Ballerini. And Miranda Lambert, she's up for an album from last year, a song from last year, but she's got a brand new double album. That may be another chance to say, hey, give us a song from your new album. You're up for a Grammy. Here's a song from your latest double album release. She's a great star, great talent. You know, so those are the things you get to do when you're in charge of the Grammy Awards.
I was surprised Margo Price wasn't in that list, the country list.
Well, was she not nominated anywhere? Well, you know. Is her album available for eligible for this year?
I don't know. I think it must be, right?
I don't know. It depends on when it came out.
A quick search, it doesn't look like she's nominated for anything. But it came out before the summer. I bought it.
It came out in March. You're talking about Midwest Farmer's Daughter. Certainly received critical acclaim. I'll bet it'll be on the Village Voice Paz and Jop poll list come the December or January, whenever that comes out. So it didn't make I don't think it's going to make my best of the year list, but it's certainly a well-reviewed, well-considered album.
Well, and you know what? I hope that you believe this show what should be well-reviewed and well-considered.
Nicely done.
Yes, indeed. You can go to any one of the podcast aggregators at iTunes or the Microsoft Marketplace, the Google Play Store, Stitcher. You can rate and review our show. You can subscribe to our show. It will come to you every week. You won't have to do anything. Every time we publish a new episode, there it will be in your podcast player. So please do subscribe to the show, rate and review the show in any of the podcast aggregators out there. And if you can't find the show in any of those, please let us know and we will fix it immediately. You can find all that information on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find ways to contact us. Dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @ShowbizSandbox. Or you can like us on Facebook. If you search for Showbiz Sandbox, our page should come up. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. Again, that's where all of that information about following us, liking us, subscribing to us can be found. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group, MGMT. They can be found on their website, who is mgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's Rogue One was absolutely .com.
I see.
You wouldn't let me say what I thought, so I didn't say.
No spoilers. Yes, indeed.
No spoilers. And next week we'll have a show, but we will skip the Christmas week. So
that is correct.
Next week a final show, and then we'll have another show in the new year.
That's right. Well, if you can't find any of Michael's work on whatever that spoiler website was, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated, or you can find some of his entertainment coverage on the Huffington Post. Of course, you should always check out bookfilter.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.